Amen. Well, welcome. It's good to see you today. You survived 2011, and now you're starting the new year right, just getting together with God's people and seeking Him and worshiping Him. And glad you chose to join us today to do that. Turn in your Bibles to the book of Nehemiah. We're going through the whole Bible in a year, roughly, and today we've come to the book of Nehemiah. Now, as we've been talking about, the books of Ezra and Nehemiah just about close off the historical section of the Old Testament. Chronologically, everything in the Old Testament happens between creation and the restoration of the kingdom in Jerusalem following the Babylonian captivity. And so Nehemiah is the second stage. Ezra came and rebuilt the temple, and Nehemiah came and rebuilt the walls of the city, and children of Israel came back and reestablished worship. The next thing that happens in the Bible is Jesus coming as a child. And so all the rest of the books of the Old Testament that we're going to study fit into that chronological picture as we go through the poetic books that are taking place in a time that's already passed, and we go through the prophetic books that were taking place pre and during the exile, right before the exile, and just shortly after. So Nehemiah tells that story. It was written probably by Ezra, but you'll notice that most of the book of Nehemiah is in first person. He talks about himself as I. And so a lot of people have figured that Nehemiah must have written Nehemiah because he says I. But Ezra and Nehemiah were together one book always in all the manuscripts. And we know that Nehemiah was a builder. Ezra was a scholar. And so probably Ezra wrote Nehemiah using Nehemiah's personal journal or records or notes or something like that in doing it. Nehemiah is an interesting guy because he is an amazing guy who does great things, but he does it not as a minister, but he does it as a layman. And often we play down the aspect of regular people getting involved in God's work. And we emphasize that, ministers, we need to hire people to do everything. But Nehemiah stands out as a great example of a guy who had a job, but was really effective at doing what God wanted him to do. So some really interesting principles as you go through the book. If you haven't read it, I would encourage you this week. It's just 13 chapters. Read a couple chapters a day and you'll get through it. But this guy, Nehemiah, stands out in my mind as a great example of a leader, a godly leader. And if we desire to influence our world, if as you look forward to the new year and you say, I would like to make a difference. And in fact, I would like to see where I live and the people I'm involved with, my church, my family, my community, I'd like to see it make positive changes. And I would like to be a change agent in accomplishing that. Then Nehemiah has some awesome principles for all of us to learn. If you want to change your world, Nehemiah has some great lessons for us. If you want to lead and inspire others to get involved doing things that are significant, again, Nehemiah, a great example. Now, and so we'll pull up some principles going through, at a fairly quick pace, but you can read it on the side by yourself and discover a lot of other things I know that I won't point out. Nehemiah chapter 1 starts out with a prayer. Nehemiah, who we find out at the end of the chapter, is a cupbearer for the Persian king, Artaxerxes, still had a heart as a Jew for what was going on in Jerusalem, even though he's working in the capital in Persia. And so Nehemiah asked people every once in a while, travelers would come through, how's everything going? Because you remember we talked about last week, we saw it in Ezra, where Artaxerxes made the declaration that people could go back and restore and rebuild Jerusalem. That was in fulfillment of the prophecy in Daniel chapter 9. And so this had gone out, permission, even funding had been provided by the government in order to go and rebuild Jerusalem. So Nehemiah, who was the cupbearer to King Artaxerxes, now let me explain, a cupbearer wasn't just someone who would hold a cup. The cupbearer became a really important, critical advisor to the king. It started out as the cupbearer was a guy who, because in their culture, you didn't have an election, you had an assassination if you wanted to bring in a better government. Some people suggest that's still more efficient than our system, but I'm not saying that. But so it was important for the king to have somebody that would taste his food before he would eat it. And so the cupbearer would be there, and somebody would bring in a nice bottle of wine, and he would taste it before the king would taste it. And if you really like wine, you might go, wow, that's a great job. You're getting the best wine there is. And as long as it's not poison, that's a good thing. Now, again, I don't expect you people second service care about wine. I think all the drinkers are going to be here third service. But you'll figure it out. But his job was to do that. So that means he was in a dangerous place. He had to be dedicated. You can understand why it's a slave who would take that role on. But over time, the king discovered, this guy's loyal. I can trust him. And so the cupbearer often also became somebody who would give advice, because he's putting his life on the line every day for the king. You might think it's a little weird that a Persian king would have a Jewish guy as his cupbearer. And again, last week we talked about this a little bit. Artaxerxes, the Persian king, his father was Xerxes I, who was also known as Ahasuerus. And next week when we study the story of Esther, we find out that Esther, a Jewish beauty queen, won this contest to become the queen, the bride of Ahasuerus, or Xerxes I, and then ultimately saved the nation of Israel. If you're not familiar with that story, read up on it before next Sunday and we'll talk about it. So Artaxerxes is a guy who either his mother or his stepmother was a Jewish beauty, was Esther. So he had a soft place in his heart. It explains why in Ezra we see him making this declaration that had been predicted by Daniel in Daniel chapter 9, but it's also why he would have the closest person to him be a Jewish guy. Perhaps he was Jewish himself, half Jewish, and maybe wouldn't publicize it, but his loyalties were showing through at least. So an interesting little twist on the story. But check out, in chapter 1, Nehemiah heard what a dump it was in Jerusalem. In verse 3, he said, the wall of Jerusalem's broken down, gates are burned with fire. Verse 4, so it was when I heard these words that I sat down and wept, and I mourned for many days. I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. And I said, I pray, Lord God of heaven, O great and awesome God, you who keep your covenant and mercy with those who love you and observe your commandments, please let your ear be attentive and your eyes open, that you may hear the prayer of your servant, which I pray before you now, day and night, for the children of Israel, your servants, and confess their sins and so on. The whole rest of the chapter is this prayer, verse 11. O Lord, I pray, please let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who desire to fear your name. And let your servant prosper this day, I pray, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man, Artaxerxes, for, in parentheses, I was the king's cupbearer. So he wants to do something. He wants to talk to the king. But first, you have this extensive, actually days of fasting and praying. And this is the first principle that I want to draw your attention to. If you want to change your world this year, And if you want to be someone who inspires other people as a godly leader, it all begins with prayer. And we see throughout the book of Nehemiah, we see prayer is essential to what he did. Now, again, this might be kind of surprising since Nehemiah essentially was a layman, not a clergyman. He wasn't some religious leader. He was more of a general contractor through most of the book, and yet he's this man of prayer. We desperately need people in all walks of life who devote themselves to serious prayer. Prayer is the way that God gets things done. It says in James chapter 5, the fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much, does a lot. Earlier in James, James said, your problem is you have not because you ask not. The old hymn says, oh, what peace we often forfeit. Oh, what needless pain we bear, all because we do not carry everything to God in prayer. It is an absolute mystery as to why people do not pray. Now, I understand why people, avoid prayer meetings, because biblically, prayer was almost never done in prayer meetings. All the praying that we see in the Bible, almost all of it was done privately. It's a battle with you and God. It's a time of simply being alone with Him. When you get with a bunch of other people praying, you start trying to impress each other. You become distracted. There are issues with that. But in the Bible, every person who ever accomplished much of anything was a person who would personally, privately commit themselves to prayer. And he had these days of prayer, but he was also constantly shooting little prayers to the Lord. As you see in chapter 2, as he goes before the king, and he took a chance because he had never been sad in the king's presence before. In those days, everybody that the king had working for him, he wanted them to be happy because that would make the king happy. Happiness is contagious. So if a guy came in the king's presence and he was sad, they would just remove him from the king's presence and often from the presence of the face of the earth. And so he was nervous, but he was bummed. He had been fasting and praying and worrying. And he was about to ask this big question. But notice when Artaxerxes said to him, why is your face sad? You're not sick. What's going on? And he told him, hey, how can I not be sad when verse 3, the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies waste and its gates are burned with fire? Then the king said to me, what do you request? Oh boy, this is the big moment. So look what he did. So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, here's the deal. So he not only prayed long prayers, but he breathed the prayer to God in the middle. And I'm sure when Artaxerxes said this, he didn't say, just a minute, let me get some people together so we can pray. I need to pray. He probably went, oh, God help. And here's the deal. But again, throughout this book, you're going to see it. A man of prayer. If you expect anything good to come out of your life, and you try to live your life apart from praying, you're an idiot. Because we have the capacity to ask God to do things, and He'll do it. He answers prayer. It makes a difference. Now, He answers it with qualification. He's not going to end up giving you something that you really don't want, but you're just foolishly asking for it. But if the Bible is correct and we are missing out on things because we don't pray, this is where we start. And this is where he started. He was a person of prayer, devoted to prayer. So if you're making some New Year's resolutions, and I don't even suggest that you should, but if you were, one of your greatest resolutions for this year, if you want to have an impact, if you want life to get better, if you want to be used by God and make a difference in people's lives, the very first thing would be, this year I'm going to pray a lot more. This year while I'm every time I'm in my car driving by myself, I'm going to be praying. This year while I'm at work doing the mindless things that are a part of my job, I'm also going to be praying. this year, before I go to bed, when I'm laying in bed, still awake, I'm going to pray. Radical difference, radical effect on our lives if we would just pray. I know for me, I go on our website and go to the prayer wall where people put their prayer requests, and you click on it when you pray, and then they know that somebody prayed for them. I love just when I have in a waiting room or somewhere else, pull up my smartphone and go to the prayer wall and just be able to pray for a few minutes. It's a way to make time productive. Now, while I'm sitting in the doctor's office, I could be reading a three-year-old boating magazine or something, or I can actually ask God to do things that he's actually going to do to make a difference. And so a godly leader is a person who prays. And if you want to change the future, you start with prayer. Now, as we move through the book, we also see in chapter 2, Nehemiah, it's interesting. He gets permission, he goes to Jerusalem, but he's there for a few days before he even tells anybody what he has in mind. Now, we would tend to think we need to get some publicity ahead of time, we need to connect with people who are there, we need to try to do advance work. But what he did, notice in verse 11 of chapter 2, "So I came to Jerusalem and I was there for 3 days. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor was there any animal with me except the one on which I rode. And I went out by night through the valley gate to the serpent well, the refuse gate. And I viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were burned with fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate and the king's pool. Couldn't get the animal through there. Went up in the night by the valley, and I viewed the wall. Then I turned back and entered by the valley gate, and I returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done. I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the others who did the work. Then I said to them, 'You see the distress that we are in. This place is a mess. Jerusalem lies waste, and its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer be a reproach or just be a joke to everyone.' And I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also of the king's words that he had spoken to me. So they said, 'Let us rise up and build.' Then they set their hands to do this good work." So Nehemiah, after he prayed, went to Jerusalem and spent a few days just to check it out. And even got up in the middle of the night to walk around just to get a fresh perspective, just to look at it, just to see, approach it as somebody who's not too close to the situation. And my point that I want to make here is people who make a difference, godly leaders, also envision. They are people who have vision. When you're too close to a situation, you start stepping over trash because you're used to it being there. You get used to it being run down. You can see this. You know, often there are people who are incredible craftsmen, and yet their own house, I've known some guys who are great contractors, but they have like, there was one guy, I remember, for years and years, he had started a bay window on the front of his house. Tore the stucco off and, you know, fastened a couple pieces of wood and never got around to doing it. And there's kind of a parable that, you know, the guy that makes shoes, his kids don't have shoes. He, you know, it's just we get too close to a situation and we don't realize what a mess it is. And this is a hazard to all of us. And it's why it helps if we have somebody from the outside sometimes, or somebody who sees from a different angle, or somebody who's really gifted in this area to come in and give you a fresh perspective. And that's where this visioneering that Disney talks about all the time comes from. Vision. It's the idea of being able to see the things that the people who are too close to it don't see because they're so used to the junk. They're so used to it being around. people become hoarders and they end up living in a place that's just crammed full of stacks of boxes and stuff. And I like watching those hoarder shows on TV because it makes my garage, the mess that it is, look so good. My study desk looks so nice because, I mean, I don't have stacks of boxes everywhere. That's what closets are for. But here, Nehemiah shows up, and before he does anything, he goes, let me take a look at this. And there are some people who are just gifted in that way, who just look at things and go, We have a guy, a friend of mine, who is a designer, who has come in recently just to help us out. He's just doing it as a friend, and he's designed some of the greatest churches in the country, huge churches. But he comes in here and he just looks and he goes, asks a couple questions. He goes, okay, here's what we're gonna do. And so the design of the new stage was that some guys put together in one day, and it's, I mean, almost done. They worked all day yesterday doing it. And the color on the walls and the dark paint on the back and putting different lighting and everything all comes because this guy has the ability to walk into a church that he's never been in. And some of you are going, oh, they painted. But he has the ability to just walk in and see it a way that it isn't and see what needs to be done in order to make it better. And some people have that gift. Nehemiah was that way. It's so important that we develop that in our own lives and everything that we're involved in. That every once in a while, we put ourselves in a position and say, okay, if I had never been here before, I'm going to walk in with a fresh perspective. Let me see this for what it is, and let me see what it could be. And that's the kind of vision that Nehemiah had. And that's what we're talking about as we move into our year. Do you want to just leave things the way they are because you're used to them? Or are you really committed to wanting to do the best that you can do with everything that God has placed before you? If you owned a business, you would love to have someone working in that business who has the ability to come in and go, you know what? If you just change this, this, and this, it would be working really good. Now, this isn't a person who can always tell you everything that's wrong. That's not what vision is. He didn't just come and go, this place is a dump. It's ugly, it's awful, it's hopeless. He came in and he goes, whew, this is looking bad, but we can fix this. We can get this. It's not impossible. It's not difficult. I'm so blessed to have Jerry Hill as a part of our staff here because Jerry has that ability to go, when I get, he sees everything that's bad and I go, ugh. And then he goes, nah, we can do this. This is definitely doable. It's not a big deal. We can make a difference. And that's what Nehemiah was like. The guy who comes and says, I see that we can do this. And so an important thing for us to develop personally if we want to make a difference moving into the next year. Another thing that we see as we come to chapters 3 and 4, after Nehemiah got them to buy in, now he organized the whole thing. There are some people who hate organization. They'd rather just wing it, do it by the seat of their pants, and, you know, kind of. And I mean, honestly, a lot of times I tend to be that person. Organization, though, without it, you don't ever get anything done right. You're always completely inefficient in all that you're doing. Now, in chapter 3, it lays out each person, each family had their own area of responsibility based on what their skills were, based on proximity to their own homes and things like that. They lay this all out. Godly leaders are organized, and it's just an important tool to use in planning what you're going to do. If you're going to fulfill a vision, you have to be able to have someone to organize it. But as we read through into chapter 4, we find out there was a lot of opposition. And so a part of organization was definitely specialization, but it was also teamwork. Because he goes on, and in verse 6, it says the people had a mind to work. And that's great. When you have people who are like, what can we do? That's That's the dream of a leader. But down in verse 13, chapter 4, I positioned men behind the lower parts of the walls at the openings, and I set the people according to their families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. Down in verse 16, so it was from that time on, half of my servants worked at construction, while the other half held the spears, the shields, the bows, and the armor. And the leaders were behind all the house of Judah. So that's specialization. The people who were good at defense were doing defense. The people who were good at building were doing building. But also, down in verse 17, he said, those who built the wall and who carried the burdens loaded themselves so that with one hand they worked at construction, and with the other they held a weapon. Every one of the builders had his sword girded at his side as he built. And as you go on and read through those chapters, you see that it was specialization, but it was also teamwork and cooperation and multitasking as well. Tool in one hand, sword in the other hand. Because, and see, a lot of times organization emphasizes specialization, but they don't emphasize a sense of cooperation. And so you, in a bad organization, people are always saying, you know, that's not my job. I won't help. Where you want people to have that flexibility to be able to cooperate. And sometimes it involves multitasking. But you also don't want people, in some organizations, people go, I don't really know what my job is. And that's a bad deal too. You need to have both. And Nehemiah was a guy who in his leadership, in his management style, he created an organizational system that was both specialized and multitasking where necessary. But if you read through this, you'll just be amazed at how he put this thing together. And, you know, really, that's not so much a gift as it is a discipline. How you choose to live your life is dependent on whether or not you will manage your life, whether you will structure it, whether you can have the discipline to divide and conquer, to break a big job up into small pieces. To fail to do that causes you to be overwhelmed most of the time and not to get anything done. This is something that may come natural to some people, but it's more a skill that people can learn and develop as they decide to live their lives under control. The fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, long-suffering, the final one is self-control. That should be where we are heading as godly people, is that we make the most of the opportunities that we have and we live disciplined lives so that we can get more done. And Nehemiah is a great challenge to us in this way. When we come to chapter 5, we see another trait Nehemiah had, though, and that is, he had a flexibility. One of the greatest dangers to organized people is they don't have flexibility. They can't bend when they need to. They become a slave to their system. But here what happened in chapter 5, people were going broke. And they were having to mortgage their property in order to survive. They were going, you know, we're so much in debt, our kids are going to be slaves. Kind of like today, where you have 70 to 80% of the people in the country whose houses, they owe more on it than what it's worth. Eventually, that's going to take away people's willingness to work. Because you're like, what? You know what? I could stop working, and I would be getting less behind than I am right now. And so that was happening. That frustration was setting in. And so Nehemiah had to consider this. Now, it's kind of tricky because the powerful people are the ones who loaned the money. And now, like in any society, there are certain people who have a way of working the system. And they're always going to come out on top. So that's kind of what was happening here. But look at verse 7, chapter 5. After serious thought, he thought about this. He considered it. He saw the problem. He hadn't thought of it before. But he said, I rebuked the nobles and rulers, and I said to them, each of you is exacting usury from his brother. So he got everybody together, and down in verse 11, restore now to them, even this day, their land, their vineyards, their olive groves, and their houses. and also a hundredth of the money and the grain and the new wine and the oil that you've charged them. And they went for it. He basically created a bankruptcy system on an emergency basis. They hadn't thought of this. Nobody anticipated it. But when you take people and you move them and you put them to work, it's difficult because at first you're not producing anything. You're trying to get them to build the temple, to build the walls. Well, none of that produces anything. And so ultimately, their wherewithal was being eaten up by the system. And so Nehemiah, in his flexibility, goes, okay, look, this isn't good. Here's what we need to do. And he just reshuffled the deck, and he made it possible for people to keep their houses, to keep their jobs. He set that as the priority. And he goes, you nobles will be fine. And they went along with it. For someone to make a difference, you have to be flexible. For someone to be a leader, to inspire people to greater things for themselves, you've got to be flexible. You can't be rigid. I often refer to rigidness as a fast food mentality. And I don't want to offend any of you who are in the fast food business, and it's changing. Some restaurants are different than others, but the classic example of it, years ago we were driving on a vacation somewhere and we pulled into McDonald's to get lunch, which normally you go to McDonald's because you're in Bakersfield or something, and where else are you going to go? And so I asked for a quarter pounder with cheese, but I wanted them to put the Big Mac special sauce on it. And so I thought that would taste good. Well, they couldn't do that. I go, why can't you do it? I'm upset with some 15-year-old kid, but I'm like, why can't you do that? I said, charge me extra. Can you give me sauce on the side? No, not for a quarter pounder with cheese. I said, well, do you have a manager? So then his 18-year-old buddy, you know, comes up and he's explaining to me why they can't do this. And his reasoning was something like this. In our laboratories, they have not tested the quarter pounder with Thousand Island dressing on it, so we can't guarantee that it won't kill you. And I'm like, well, if I bought both and I took sauce off one and the other, he goes, you do that at your own risk. It's like when I go to Israel and I really want a cheeseburger, but the kosher laws don't let you do it. I always have to buy a slice of cheese pizza in one place and a hamburger in another place, peel the cheese off and stick it in the burger. But sorry if that offends you, Orthodox. But a leader has to be able to look at something and go, we can fix this. It's okay. Organization does not mean rigidity. Now, as you read on in chapter 5, you see also that Nehemiah was generous. He never took a salary, even though he had a salary allocated to him, but he could afford not to. And a part of his helping with the bad economy was that he was willing to chip in a little extra himself in order to feed several people and keep them going, and he never took his own salary. But again, it's this flexibility that would be a good thing for us to determine in the next year. We're going to be a little more flexible. We're not just going to go, well, I'm living by the rules. I mean, a lot of people, I hate it when people say, you know, the Bible is God's rule book for how to live. If you think that, you have ignored everything that Jesus said in the Gospels, because everything that he was saying was addressing to the Pharisees. No, this isn't a rule book. You're not to live by rules. You have the Holy Spirit that God will place inside of you. You don't have to be all, you know, afraid of stepping outside your box or of doing things a certain way. You listen to God and you do what he shows you. Sometimes on the Sabbath, you heal somebody or you pull an animal out of a ditch. Don't be an idiot because of some rule. And I think sometimes we can turn the Christian life into a whole bunch of rules. That's not what it's supposed to be. God never designed it to be that way. There's flexibility. You have to ask yourself, is this worth it? Is this worth the hassle that it's going to take me to deal with it? And so godly leaders are flexible. People who change the world are flexible. They're not locked into rigidity. Now in chapter 6, One of the things that we see also about Nehemiah is he has an incredible sense of priorities. And for this point, I call it godly leaders' focus. There were these guys, Tobiah and Sanballat and an Arab guy, Geshem, who were their enemies, trying to stop people from doing what God was doing. And in verse 2, Sanballat and Geshem sent to Nehemiah a message and said, "Come, let us meet together among the villages in the plain of Ono." But they thought to do me harm. In other words, they didn't have my good in mind. "So I sent messengers to them saying, 'I am doing a great work so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and go down to you?'" Well, they sent the message like 4 or 5 times without him answering. The longest answer he gave him finally was, "Look, I'm not doing it. You're making this stuff up." They were starting to say that, "Oh, I think that you're doing this. I think you're doing that." And he goes, "No, I'm not." And that was it. But notice the focus that Nehemiah had. He said, "I know that what I'm doing is a great work." And by the way, every day, if you don't know that what you're doing is a great work, you should do something else. You should find something great to do in that situation. But there are always going to be people who want to pull you off task, as Sanballat and Tobiah were. People who go, "Oh, let's have a meeting." So much of our lives are wasted in meetings. It's just ridiculous. If you think about the times that you sat in a meeting for an hour and a half, and everything that happened in there could have been done in a 5-minute email or a message. But it's like, "No, we have to have a meeting. We have to have a meeting." People always hate to bring me into meetings because I just make fun of the meeting. But, you know, it's every day you only have so many minutes to do something that matters. First of all, it's important to know that what you're doing matters. And secondly, it's important to not let somebody else's concern pull you from that which you are supposed to be doing, that you are called to do important things. Our society has created electronic interruptions in everything in our lives. So when my phone rings, it doesn't matter what I'm doing. It's somebody wants to intrude right now. What they care about. And thank God for caller ID, because there are some people who call me constantly and they've never called me with anything that mattered. And so other times it's like, "I don't recognize this number. Something might be wrong with one of the kids." No, you know, it's an electronic voice mail telling me something. But these intrusions are constant in our society. And, you know, people think that since they sent you an email that you have to respond. Since they called and left you a message, you need to call them back. And the second time they get back to you, it's almost like, "What's the matter? Didn't you get my message?" Well, get this message. It might be that something I'm doing is more important than whatever it is that you wanted. I don't want to meet with you. I feel no need to meet with you. I don't care what it is that you're doing. I feel like what I'm doing is important, and I have to choose to do what I do that feels most important. Now, I do get pulled off constantly, and after first service, somebody goes, "Hey, you know, we need to have a meeting." Okay, I do. I do meetings. Not that I don't do meetings, but I recognize the need to know what Nehemiah knew, and that is I need to keep my focus on what matters most. You know, because if I answer every call of people who call me, and I pretty much do, if I answer every email that someone sends me, and I pretty much do, if I return every call, and I pretty much do, what happens is I'm up at 2:00 in the morning to try to focus on doing what God has called me to do, because all day long I was in meetings, I was responding to people, I was letting people steal my life. Letting people steal the gift of time that God has given me. And it's hard because many of us, I'm very guilty of this, and probably most of us have an element of this, we're people pleasers. I don't want anybody to be out there mad at me because I didn't do what they wanted me to do. So instead, I ruined my life trying to do everything that everybody wants me to do. And a smart leader understands I need to keep a focus. And the truth is that a lot of those people that want to meet with you and you don't really feel the need to meet with them, or they won't even tell you what they want to meet about. That's your first clue. Chances are, after the meeting, they're still going to be mad at you if you don't do what they want you to do. I gave you an hour. Yeah, but I want you to institute this program. I want you to pitch this ministry. I want you to use our services. I want you to... They're still not going to be happy. So Nehemiah was the kind of guy who goes, you know what? I have something more important than a meeting. And it may be hard for you to understand, but I actually have something more important than you right now. And I have to do that. And that's difficult. But that kind of discipline is necessary in our lives. You know, if you have friends who are high maintenance, who call you and they want to tell you their whole story for 2 hours about how miserable they are and their life's terrible and they just don't know, and you've heard the story before a bunch of times, and they don't take your advice when you tell them what they should do, but they just feel good about telling someone. Okay, if you choose to do that, what are you choosing not to do? What is it that time, and you know, I do this. You listen to all their sob stories, and then great. You know what you accomplished? Now two of us feel bad. It used to be just you. Now it's me too. But also, what could I have done with that time? Could I have spent some time resting? Could I have been walking on the beach appreciating God's beauty? Could I have been calling one of my kids and seeing how they're doing? Could I have been in prayer? Could I have been visioneering? I mean, how much is taken away from us because we give into the tyranny of the urgent? And because somebody else's emergency constitutes something that needs to become our emergency. You're never going to please everyone. It's so important as we move into a new year to decide what it is you do that matters and learn to say no to things that, they're good things, but good is always the enemy of great and best, always. And so to have that kind of discipline in our lives where we just go, I'm sorry, but I can't do that, right? That doesn't fit with my schedule. That's not something, what I'm doing, as Nehemiah said, why should the work cease while I leave it and go down to you? A sense of the fact that what I'm doing matters. If you haven't thought about what you're doing and whether it matters or not, then you need to get off and consider that. But once you feel that you know, here's what matters, here are my priorities, now you need to have dogged discipline to make sure that no one else puts their monkey on your back and steals from you the ability for you to do your best at what it is that you're called to do. And so good, godly leaders focus. Over in verse 15 in chapter 6, it's just one line, but man, it says a mouthful. Verse 15, so the wall was finished on the 25th day of Elul in 52 days. Are you kidding me? 52 days dealing with the city and all that kind of stuff. It took us like 2 years to put up a trailer park, you know? And it 52 days, he got it done. And the thing I want to emphasize to you about Nehemiah is, like any great godly leader, he got things done. It's not what you start. It's what you finish. And sometimes it's better to do less and get it done than to do a bunch of things. In the past, I've started lots of projects because it looks, yeah, that's something I really want to do. It's a good thing. And I get it started, but then I get something else started. And I carry this burden on my head. There's so many things that I need to get done. Really, why? We had years ago at Calvary, we had a first-year teacher who was overwhelmed. And Mary Roberts, who was one of our vice principals, walked into, saw her light on, it's like 11 o'clock at night, and went into her classroom, and she's there, and Mary goes, "What are you doing here this late?" And the teacher just broke down crying. And she had a stack of papers, like 2 feet deep, to grade that night. She goes, "I just have to get this done." And Mary took that whole stack and walked over and just dropped it in the trash. And she goes, "How do you feel now?" She goes, "Better." I'm convinced that some of us need to look through some of our unfinished projects and just throw them away. Don't think of, "Oh, but I paid so much for all that yarn for, and I have one arm of a sweater that's," just throw it away. What's the yarn? What's that worth to you as it's weighing on you that it's not done? And see, good godly leaders are the ones who know what they're supposed to do and they actually finish. They actually get it done. It's better to do less things and finish them than to be known as the person who's always starting something and never following through and getting it done. I'm amazed what people can do. Like yesterday with a few guys and Mark was running the thing. I thought, and when he said, "No, it'll be useful on Sunday, don't worry." I'm like, I thought I'd be up here standing on sawhorses. But they worked until it was useful. And they'll get this thing done. And that's what in all areas of our lives. If we want to make a difference, we need to decide that we want to be that kind of person. I'm going to finish what I started, or I'm fine quitting what I started. Just don't leave it hanging out there. Finish something. And that would be a good resolution for all of us going into the next year. Over in chapter 8, we see another really important aspect of leadership. Ezra began to read the law to the people. They gathered all the people together and they read the law. And we see this description in verse 8 of chapter 8, and it kind of describes what we do when we get together here at church. So they read distinctly from the book, made it clear, the law of God, and they gave the sense, explained what it meant, and they helped them to understand the reading. That is, they go, "Well, here's how this might have an effect on your life." So as they were teaching, as you read through this, the people began to cry because they realized there's so much wrong. There's so much that we're not doing that we should be doing, and they were becoming discouraged. But look at what, in verse 9, what Nehemiah said, "This day is holy to the Lord your God. Do not mourn nor weep." For all the people wept when they heard the words of the law. Then he said to them, "Go your way, eat the fat, drink the sweet, send portions to those for whom nothing is prepared. For this day is holy to our Lord. Do not sorrow, for the joy of the Lord is your strength." In verse 12, all the people went their way to eat and drink, send portions, rejoice greatly, because they understood the words that were declared to them. The joy of the Lord is your strength. Whatever it is that you're doing for God, if you look like it makes you look miserable, it will not work. Nehemiah understood this. If I get a bunch of people who are all depressed and bummed out, I'm not going to get things done. And so he said, "Hey, you see what God has told you. You know where you're wrong. Celebrate that, because now you can do differently." When we leave one year and move into the next, it's a great time to go, 2011 is over. 2012 is fresh. We really haven't messed it up too much yet. So let's just celebrate and go, good things are ahead because there's a good God who's working. You know, I've never heard of anyone coming up to someone and saying, "You know, I've been watching you and I've noticed you're one of the saddest people I've ever known. You always look miserable. You're always frowning. Whenever something comes up in discussion, you're telling us, oh, everything that's bad in the world and what's wrong and, you know, the Mayan calendar and everything." And, you know, I see you being so miserable, and I just wanted you to ask you, how could I have what you have? How can I be as miserable as you are? People don't do that. But if they see someone who has joy, that has strength. and power, because everyone wants joy. Now you go, but yeah, well, nothing's joyful's happening in my life. Really? So God just isn't doing anything at all. Is that the deal? Boy, how warped. Paul, while he was in prison writing to the Philippians, his whole book was about joy. And he kept saying, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say, rejoice. Why? Because all you have to do is discover what God is doing, and then you have a reason to celebrate. Now, if you're really myopic and you only see your own little world, yeah, maybe there's nothing going on right now that you see. But when you see what God is doing for others and in other places, and just knowing his nature and character, you will find reasons to rejoice. You really will. People who are miserable are completely worthless and ineffective. They can even do a lot of good things, but in terms of inspiring others, it'll never happen. I saw one guy who just, I see him every week, and he's just always so miserable. And I thought, yeah, after this message, I bet he's going to feel better. So as I was walking around to go to the back door, I saw him heading to his car, and I go, hey, Happy New Year. And he goes, he'll be here next week. He's fine. I love the guy. But, you know, some people are just that way. They will never have strength. They will always be weak. The joy of the Lord is your strength. Now, later on in chapter 12, we see more of this, where Nehemiah organizes in verse 27 and following, he organizes a celebration for the dedication of the city walls. And it's interesting that this contractor is now telling people, even the religious leaders, you stand here, we're going to put part of the choir here, we're going to put part of the choir here, and the musicians are going to go here, and we're going to have this amazing celebration. Because he understood the joy of the Lord is your strength. Now, some people are so miserable that they don't want anyone trying to get them to even smile. And I've been there, where it's just like, somebody goes, I mean, I've been dealing with horrible things all week, and somebody comes up, come on, smile. Oh, you know, but there are some people who just live their life that way. But the truth is, sometimes we need to be told to celebrate, and Nehemiah understood that, and he structured it. You know, there are some churches where they force a celebration, and sometimes we look at it and go, oh, that seems so phony. Because they're just like, okay, come on, everybody get up, everybody clap, or let's give a clap offering to the Lord, let's do it. And we can very skeptically look at that and go, that's weird. But you know what? If you go to a church like that, it's also contagious that you get with people like that and you like want to be more like that. And you go, oh, but that's manipulation. Well, maybe, but think about it this way. My wife doesn't care at all about football. She really doesn't. And sometimes she'll say, well, I watch football with you. That means she's in the kitchen cooking while I'm watching a football game. But she always wants to know when it's in overtime. Because now she comes over, and now it's the exciting part. And she's cheering and screaming for both teams. It doesn't matter. She's like, go, go Texans. Where are the Texans from? You know. And it's like, but she's whipped up. And now she's having a great time. She all of a sudden, I love football. Well, because you're being taken to a place of joy. And everybody loves joy. I mean, I think, frankly, in our church, we're a bit too stuffy sometimes. That if people start to clap, we're like, okay, nope, something serious. Let's get back to something serious. Nehemiah understood. People want to celebrate. They want to rejoice. They just need to be organized to do it. They need to be led to do that. And so we see him as a guy who understood that being positive and being joyful is critical. A good resolution for this year is to just bring joy into more people's lives, to celebrate just a bit more, to be positive instead of always just being negative. To be going, yeah, this is great. Good things are happening. There are some people that whenever I ask them how they are, they smile and they go, God is so good. And they'll tell me what God's doing. I know other people that if I say, how are you doing? I better grab a chair Because they're going to tell me everything that's wrong in every part of their body, in every part of their family, and everything else. Just that's the way they're organized. People like that are frankly weak and worthless. Strength comes from God's joy. And then finally, chapter 13 makes the point, and our time is up, so I'm not going to go through and read it to you, but you can read it. Nehemiah had gone back to his work. Probably needed to make some money after all that he went through. But he finally, after a period of time, he comes back to Jerusalem and he sees, oh man, things are a mess. I mean, that guy Tobiah, that had been the big guy who was trying to stop everything, well, he knew how to kiss up to people. And so he had people who liked him because of relatives that he had who were leaders and stuff. In the temple, they cleared out a room that was supposed to be for the tithes, and they gave him a condo. He's living right in there. And then they're disregarding the Sabbath laws. They're doing whatever they want to do, whenever they want to do it, opening the stores on the Sabbath and everything. And he's just like, this is frustrating to me. And then he, on top of that, he goes and they've started to intermarry. And so people are, and by the way, when the Bible talks about intermarriage, it's never about racial intermarriage. Some of the greatest examples of romance in the Bible were interracial marriages, and some of them are in the line of Christ. But when people marry outside their faith, it messes up their kids. And he goes, some of the kids didn't even speak Hebrew, didn't know any, you know, they're like little foreigners from these pagan cultures. They're taking on the, so anyhow, he comes back and he goes, this is going to change. And so he goes into Tobiah's condo and he dumps all his stuff right out on the streets. And then he goes, by the way, this room was supposed to be for the money that people tithe in order to support the ministers, the Levites. What's going on with them? And he finds out that the Levites had to go back and go to work because they could no longer be supported because people weren't giving to that purpose. And so he goes, that's going to change. And he just went around and insisted that people would give money so the ministers could be paid. And then he went and locked the gates of the city on Friday night. Nobody could do trade. He scared off people, some of the foreigners, from doing it. And then he goes to the, over in chapter 13, and look at, he was a positive, gentle guy, but in verse 25, as he's dealing with these people, he says, so I contended with them and cursed them. He wasn't a minister, so he could do that. I struck some of them and pulled out their hair, and I made them swear by God, saying, you shall not give your daughters as wives to their sons, nor take their daughters for sons for yourself. And what I see from chapter 13 is Nehemiah had integrity. He was not a politician. He was not just saying what people wanted to hear. Oh, he was all for joy and celebration, but when it was called for, he would put himself personally on the line to go, no, we're not going to pretend like what you're doing is okay. No, we are not going to just love you because you're a wonderful person and not speak up about the truth of who you are and what you're doing. And he was willing to. And you kind of wonder if the church could use a few Nehemiahs, but everything he did was a felony. But, you know, but just to go, no, you're not going to do that. We're not going to treat our people that way. That was Nehemiah, ultimately, a man with integrity. And so looking back through the book, he was a man who prayed. He was a man with vision. He was a leader who organized. He was a leader who was flexible. He was a leader who maintained his focus. He was a leader who got things done. He was a leader who was positive and celebrating. And he was a leader who had integrity. When you go down that list and when you think about that, if you want this year to count, and you would like to be the kind of person who actually makes the year something better because of you being involved, then these are some great guidelines as to what you might want to pray about, that what in your life you can adjust in order to become more like what an effective biblical leader actually looks like. You can change your world if you allow God to do the work in your life to make you and me more like this. So just a great reminder. Let's pray. God, thanks for your word. It's really helpful and practical for us, and we appreciate it. As we now look into a new year, God, we want this year to be better. And we want to put our lives on the line so that if we need to change in order for this year to be better, we want to do that. So give us wisdom. I pray that as we look through this book and as we go over this list, we will personally see which of these areas should be our focus this year. Lead and guide us, Lord. God, I thank you for the effective people that you surround us with who show us how to live this way. Help us to learn our lessons from Nehemiah and others. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand. If you're here and you don't know Jesus, you've never really given your life to him, you can try all these other things, but they're not going to matter if you're not connected to God and have his Spirit living inside of you. So if you really want your life to change and you haven't given it to Jesus today, come on down to the front. There are people down here who would love to pray with you. If you need prayer for any reason, times are tough, you're confused, something about the message you don't understand, come down and get some prayer. But let's start this year right. And let's move forward, determining to be more like the men and women that God calls us to be. May God bless you richly this week, and may 2012 be a time when you see God do things that you never even dreamed he could do. God bless.